First of all, I just want to thank Rabbi Schneidman for speaking very meaningfully and setting the tone for this ceremony, as he has done for so many years in the past, and with Hashem's help will continue to do for many years in the future. A few weeks or months ago, when Mr. Speer and Mr. Harwit came over to me to ask about who we should bring for the presentation for Kristallnacht, so the idea that they floated was that we should bring Rabbi J.J. Schachter. And even though Rabbi Schachter spoke at a Kristallnacht commemoration a number of years ago in 2004, the feeling was that it was worthwhile bringing him back again, because between 2004 and now, our shul has, Baruch Hashem, grown, and it's appropriate that the people of my generation should come and should hear from Rabbi Schachter, who's going to speak about Kristallnacht and its relevance, national catastrophe, and national memory. Rabbi Schachter is perfectly poised to talk about the relevance of Kristallnacht. He is a Talmud Chacham and a scholar, a rabbi and an academic. His doctorate is from Harvard University, and his smicha is from Masifta Torah V'Das. And he has spent his career not only writing articles and books, but taking themes from history, themes that are from the distant past. And for many of us in the room tonight, Kristallnacht and the Holocaust is from the distant past. But giving these events meaning, giving them a Yiddish atam, giving them a sense of importance for the lives that we live today. Rabbi Schachter also has a personal connection to the Holocaust. His father, who should have a refuah shleima and be strong, Rabbi Herschel Schachter, was part of the liberation, was the chaplain who actually liberated Buchenwald. And there are famous pictures of Rav Schachter's father and the Jews who he saw, seeing a Jew, not just a Jew, but a Rav, and what that meant for them. And for our shul to be able to take Kristallnacht and to make it meaningful, to connect to so much of the heritage of this shul, so much to learn for people of my generation is very, very meaningful. It's very important. And we hope that Rabbi Schachter will be able to give us some deeper meaning. Rabbi Schachter.
When I stand before you here, judges of Israel, to lead the prosecution of Adolf Eichmann, I am not standing alone. With me are 6 million accusers, but they cannot rise to their feet and point an accusing finger towards him who sits in the dock and cry, "I accuse." For their ashes are piled up on the hills of Auschwitz and the fields of Treblinka and are strewn in the forests of Poland. Their graves are scattered throughout the length and breadth of Europe. Their blood cries out, but their voice is not heard. Therefore, I will be their spokesman, and in their name I will unfold this awesome indictment. So began the opening speech of the Honorable Gideon Hausner, the Attorney General of the State of Israel and the lead prosecutor In the case of Israel versus Adolf Eichmann, on April 17th, 1961 in Yerushalayim. And so I begin tonight, almost 50 years later, at this Kristallnacht commemoration, in this very special shul and community. We are gathered here tonight to speak for them, for those who cannot rise to their feet, for those whose voices cannot be heard, whose ashes are piled up on the hills of Auschwitz and the fields of Treblinka, whose ashes are strewn in the forests in Poland, and whose graves are scattered through the length and breadth of Europe. In their memory and in their name, we pronounce this evening this awesome obligation. Zachor, gedenkt, remember. 72 years ago tonight, all hell broke loose in Germany and Austria. The night of November 9th, the day of November 10th, in 1938, as Rabbi Schneidman shared with us a moment ago, 76 shuls were totally demolished, 191 additional shuls were burnt down, 815 Jewish-owned businesses were destroyed, 7,500 Jewish shops were looted, 30,000 Jews were taken into custody, thousands more were subjected to wanton violence and sadistic tortures, and close to 100 Jews were killed. 17-year-old Herschel Grinspan killed the third secretary in the German embassy in Paris, and the rest, as we say, is history. Kristallnacht was forever etched into the national and historical consciousness of the Jewish people. If you turn to the first page of the sheets that I prepared for you this evening, the left-hand side, I Xeroxed for you the lead editorial in the New York Times on November 11th, 1938. In a day of terror surpassing anything even the Third Reich has seen, synagogues have been burned, shops sacked and looted, homes raided, a number of citizens beaten and thousands jailed. In Vienna, a new wave of suicides swept over a people already broken and terrorized beyond endurance. This is the lead editorial of the New York Times. These victims have never seen Poland or Paris. They were not Poles and Germans, nor were they set upon by mobs. The patriots arrived in automobiles, went about the work of destruction with method and precision, wore the boots which go with the uniform of stormtroopers and other Nazi units. The police looked on until after 14 hours of violence, the orgy was officially called off by Dr. Goebbels. More than glass was ruthlessly smashed on that night. Jewish life in Germany and beyond was irrevocably changed. In rapid succession, German Jewry was fined 1 billion mark, roughly around $400 million. Bank accounts of Jews were restricted. Retail establishments of Jews were shut. Stock holdings of Jews were seized. Jews were prohibited from either purchasing or selling real estate. Jews could no longer drive cars, were required to live in circumscribed areas. The right-hand side of page one, Time magazine. December 5th, less than a month later, 1938. How 62 prosperous German Jews were forced to run a bloody gauntlet at Sachsenhausen concentration camp was reported last week in the Liberal News Chronicle of London. two long ranks of Adolf Hitler's personal Schutzstaffel formed the gauntlet down which the 62 Jews were forced to run. Quote, as they approached between the ranks, a hail of blows fell upon them, said the News Chronicle. As they fell, the Jews were beaten further. The orgy lasted half an hour. 12 of the 62 were dead, with skulls smashed. All the others were unconscious, some with their eyes out and faces flattened in. Police, unable to bear their cries, turned their backs. Time magazine, December 5th, 1938. The nauseating atrocity, whether or not the Honest News Chronicle was correctly informed as to exactly what happened, is undoubtedly the truth in the sense that such atrocities do occur today in many parts of Germany, especially in the countryside. This shul is to be commended for commemorating Kristallnacht already for 29 years and for drawing attention to this most horrible event that, from the perspective of many, marked the beginning of the Holocaust. Rabbi Schneidman earlier spoke about how this opened the eyes, this event opened the eyes, not of everyone, but of many. And we acknowledge the presence of Rabbi Schwartz, Rabbi Schneidman. I want to thank Nomi Gates Monash for everything she did to put together tonight's program and for working with me to make sure that whatever I needed was taken care of, and the leadership and the members of the Adult Ed Committee in this shul. Holocaust memory is central to the essence of this congregation. So many of you understand that, but in particular, fueled by the efforts of strong and tenacious survivors, and we collectively are very grateful. I want to say a word about survivors. I stand in absolute awe of you, survivors, witnesses to the utter depravity of humanity at its very worst, and examples of the strength and fortitude and hope and greatness of humanity at its very best. Exposed as you were to the most malignant radiation of human cruelty, you emerged from your experiences not with fantasies of revenge, but rather with fantasies of respectability and human decency. You responded to the total assault of death by an extraordinary outpouring of life. After experiencing what you did, and nobody who wasn't there can possibly imagine, can possibly begin to imagine, after experiencing what you did, you started again and you created a new world. Nobody could have done it better than you. The young people who are here and those of us who did not personally go through what the survivors went through, but don't even begin to imagine and can't even at all conceptualize even a minutia of what went on with all the stories that we may have heard. We need to have derech eretz for the survivors. We need to pray for their welfare. And we need to go over to them and we need to ask them for brachas. We need to bow our heads in their presence and ask them to bless us, because there could be no greater role model for commitment to life and for commitment to Judaism that we will ever, ever again meet in our entire lives. Holocaust memory is important for all of us. Zachor es asher asolacha amalek is a mitzvah to say. And the lessons of the Shoah, in case we need to be reminded, are as relevant today as they ever were. I want this evening to make a case, maybe we'll call it a historical case or maybe a conceptual case, for the primacy of Dafka Kristallnacht in the realm of Holocaust memory. I want to make a case as to why specifically Kristallnacht needs to be considered, needs to be favored in the world of Holocaust memory. And I want to begin at the end of the 12th century. If you turn to page 2, I want to begin with an event that happened in a small town in France in the year 1171. This is going to be a little bit of a historical analysis, but our goal is to extract from the historical analysis a lesson and a message that is deeply relevant for us as we gather here this evening. Sometime around Pesach in 1171, a Jew by the name of Isaac, the son of Elazar, was walking along the Loire River as it courses through the town of Blois, B-L-O-I-S, in south central France. This Jew was carrying with him some skins, some hides that he had just purchased from one of the burghers in town. And it was dusk, and coming towards him by the bank of the river was a Christian servant on a horse. Christian servant couldn't figure out exactly what was going on in front of him. The horse was confused. It was dusk. There was this white apparition coming towards them. The horse threw the Christian servant off. Christian servant falls on the ground and immediately makes his way to the local prince and informs the local prince that just now by the banks of the Loire River, he, the Christian servant, saw a Jew disposing of the corpse of a Christian child. It's now 1171. For now, some 30 years, the ritual murder accusation is front and center in the medieval Jewish experience. Started earlier in England. The first two examples are in England. Now, for the first time, we have an example in continental Europe. The Jews kill Christian babies to use their blood for ritual purposes, and this Christian servant alleged to his master that he saw a Jew by the water throwing the body of the Christian baby into the water. For the first time, there was no body that was ever discovered. In the first two cases, a body was produced. A dead Christian baby's body was produced. There's no body. For all kinds of reasons that aren't relevant now, this was taken very seriously. And beginning of June in 1171, either 31 or 33 Jews, depending on the manuscript, 31 or 33 Jews were burnt at the stake in Blois for the alleged crime that they committed of killing this Christian child. If you look in the top right-hand side, there was a letter that was sent from the Orléans community. Orléans is about 20 minutes upriver from Blois. It's the next largest community where there were Jews. The Orléans community found out what happened in Blois down the river, sent out a letter to a number of other places, and writes in this letter as follows. Vayareach Hashem es reach hanichoach. You recognize the sacrificial imagery here, that these dead were not just dead, that there's some kind of a teleology here, that somehow they were considered to be korbanos, they were considered to be sacrifices. Vayareach Hashem es reach hanichoach berevi b'shabbos. It was on a Wednesday, be'esrim l'chodesh Sivan, on the 20th of the month of Sivan, Bishnas 1171. The day on which all these Jews were burnt at the stake, one day, all on one day, was the 20th of Sivan in 1171. This is so horrific, this is so terrible, that it's worthy that the totality of the Jewish people should fast on Chav Sivan to commemorate what happened to these Jews in Blois. The Godol Yiyek Vod Atzom Azem Itzom Gedalia Ben Achikam. It's even more chashuv, it's even more significant than the old biblical fast of Tzom Gedalia, Ki Yom Kippurim Hu. It's a veritable day of atonement. So the Jews in Orléans feel so wrenched by this experience that they suggest, as they let the Jewish world know what happened, that it's appropriate to commemorate this terrible event by instituting a fast day, L'chol B'nei Amenu, all Jews. Number of decades later, Reb Ephraim of Bonn writes a sefer called Sefer Zechira, top left, in which he describes the various tragedies that happened subsequent to the Crusades in the second half of the 12th century. And he has a section on Blois, the Blois massacre, and he writes as follows. Top left, Haravi B'Shabbos on Wednesday, Esrim B'Sivan, the 20th of Sivan, in the year 1171. In fact, that is precisely what happened. Kibluhu kol kihilot sorfat v'iyeh hayam v'rainos liyom sfod v'taynos. That in fact, all the communities of France, v'iyeh hayam, and the islands at the end of the sea, the islands at the end of the sea in the 12th century were England and surrounding islands. All the Jews in France, all the Jews in England, v'rainos, and all the Jews in the Rhineland, as a matter of fact, did accept this day is a fast day, meritzon nafsham, because they themselves were convinced that it was worthy to be so designated. U'b'mitzvat ha-gaon Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Arav Rab Meir. Not only did they do this alone, but they did it at the behest of Rabbeinu Yaakov, the son of Rab Meir. Rabbeinu Yaakov, the son of Rab Meir, is the great Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam, one of the greatest Jews in the 12th century, the grandson of Rashi. Rabbeinu Tam, who was to die a few weeks later, after Chav Sivan 1171. This is now at the very end of Rabbeinu Tam's life, and we are told that he, Rabbeinu Tam, also insisted that this day should be so commemorated and marked. Asher katava lehem sfarim v'hodiyum, ki ra'ui hu l'kovo tzom l'chol b'nei amenu, v'godol yia tzom azeh mitzom gedalia ben achikam, ki yom kippurim. And so we have evidence that after 1171, there was a fast day that was established on the 20th of Sivan to commemorate an event that happened on that day in Blois in 1171. 31 or 33 Jews are burnt at the stake. Now let's move fast forward to the middle of the 17th century in Poland. By the time we come to the middle of the 17th century, there are no Jews who are living in France. And there are no Jews who are living in Iye Hayam. And there are almost no Jews who are living in the Rhinus. Jews have been expelled from Western Europe. They've made their way to Eastern Europe. And Poland becomes the central address for the vast majority of Ashkenazi Jews who had previously lived in Sorfat, Iye Hayam, Verinus. 1648, they expected that the Mashiach would come. We have a tradition that Afopishi Yismamea, Im Kolzea Chakalo, and Imam in Bemuna Shlema, Bevias HaMashiach. And there's a long history of trying to identify exactly when the Mashiach is going to come, and there were people who said that in the year 1648, the Mashiach will come, but instead of Mashiach, Bogdan Chmelnitsky came and wreaked havoc with Eastern and Central European Jewry. Hundreds of Jewish communities are destroyed, known as Gzerot Tach Vetat, the Gzerot, the decrees of 1648, 1649, the Chmelnitsky massacres. Thousands and thousands of Jews are killed. In 1650, there is a respite. And the Jewish community tries to figure out how to put the pieces together again. You understand that that's their primary obligation, is to try to figure out a way how to continue Jewish life after tragedy and after catastrophe. It's not something we're unfamiliar with. And they also wanted to remember what happened. We are a people with memories, and we remember, and we want to make sure that not only we remember, but future generations will remember. The most important book that was published to describe what happened during the Khmelnytsky massacres is entitled Yevei Metzula, The Abyss of Despair by Rav Nosson Natahanover, who himself was a survivor. And he tells us on the bottom right of page 2 that the whole thing started in June of 1648, and it started, 3 lines from the bottom, on the right-hand side, Vayi b'yom dalet, and it was on a Wednesday, Chaf Sivan, on the 20th of the month of Sivan, Bo'u ha-kozakin samach li'ir Nemirov. It started in Nemirov, and it started on a Wednesday, and it started in Nemirov on a Wednesday, on the 20th of the month of Sivan. And in 1650, when they were trying to figure out, after they addressed the question of putting together the pieces, they tried to figure out a way how to commemorate this, they were faced with a question that after Blois was not an issue. After Blois, it was absolutely obvious on which day they can commemorate what happened in Blois, because it all happened on one day. So there's no question, of course, we're going to commemorate it on the day it happened. Well, this time it didn't all just happen on one day. This time it happened on a year and a half. From the middle of June through the beginning of 1650, June 1648, year and a half, almost 2 years. So if I know that my tradition says that I have to set aside a day to commemorate, because that's how we Jews do things, we set aside days. So for the first time now, they're confronted with a question of which day? Why should one day have greater yichus than another day? Which day are you going to choose? What's the criteria to determine what day should be favored as the day of commemoration for tragedy that happens for a year and a half plus? And so the decision was made, says Rabbi Hanover on the bottom left of page 2. The decision was made, you know what? Yataka right. I don't know what day to choose. But there's a logic. And the logic says, and you'll see my argument for Kristallnacht. The logic says, you know what? Let's do it on the day it began. Yesterday there was no pogrom and massacre. Today there's a pogrom and a massacre. Today, for the first time, Jews are being killed. Yes, I know it lasts for a year and a half. But if I have to choose a day, it makes sense. I'm going to choose the day on which it began. That day somehow stands out. And therefore they decided, bottom left, page 2, says Rabbi Hanover, that when the dust settled, and there was a shtickler respite, there was a moment where they could catch their breath. For Osu Lohem, Gaone Eretz Da'arba Aratzot. This is called the Council of the Four Lands, which was the super communal governmental structure that was in charge of Eastern and Central European Jewry. When the leaders of the Va'ad Arba Aratzot, what they did was Harbe Takonos Hagunos, they did all kinds of important enactments to make sure that Jewish life would continue. V'tiknu Tanit Tzibur L'chol Medina Poland. B'yom Esrim B'chodesh Sivan L'dorot. And they established a fast day. That's what we do. And they did it on the 20th of Sivan. For all generations. It's not a one-time thing. It's not only for them. It is L'dorot, L'dorei, Dorot, for the future. Why that day? Bo B'yom Shanasu Harigot Nemirov. Kayadu Alakol. The day on which Nemirov was first attacked, as is well known. Shaita Kihila Rishona. Shemasru atzmam laharigal kedushat Hashem. That was the first time. We're going to do it after the day that it began. Zrutam ta'amod lanu v'Hashem yinkom dama. So lo and behold, there's something remarkable. In 1171, they established a fast day on the 20th of Sivan for what happened in Blois. There are those who say that Rabbi Ephraim of Bonn was mistaken, that in fact there really was never such a fast day that was originally established. But even if it was established, it somehow fell out of the suitcase of Jewish practice as Jews moved from west to east in the 14th century and in the 15th century and in the 16th century. So that by the time we come to the 17th century, there's another fast day. That's established on the 20th of Sivan. This time, for a massive Jewish tragedy that lasted for more than a year and a half, because that's the day on which it began. If you look on page 3, the first two sources on page 3 deal with the question of, so did they really know in 1650 what happened in 1171? Was there some kind of a historical memory in Polish Jewry that maybe somewhere a light bulb went off and they said to themselves, oh my God, I can't believe it. This is unbelievable. This rings some kind of a bell in me, because Epis a Lichmer and Cup somewhere, that somewhere way back when, in the shrouded mists of the past, we already had a fast day on the 20th of Sivan because of what happened in 1171. If you look at the Pinkas at the top of page 3, the Pinkas of the Council of the Four Lands describes two reasons why they chose the 20th of Sivan. Why did they choose in 1650 the 20th of Sivan? Kiblu alehem va'al zaram acharehem, at the end of the third line, beginning of the fourth line, top of the page 3, at a meeting that took place in Lublin between Purim and Pesach in 1650, a decision was made to fast throughout the four lands on the 20th of Sivan. Why? Number one, asher hitchila hatzara b'kil kedosh ha'nemarav. Number one, the same reason that we saw earlier in the case of Reb Nosson Otto Hanover, that's when it began. V'hayom ahu nichpila bo hatzara. That in fact they did know, and they did have a memory of what happened earlier in 1171, and according to this source, that also somehow factored into the decision to choose the 20th of Sivan. So we have a double consideration. Number one, that's when it began, and number two, it resonates with us already from an event that happened close to 500 years before. And we find the same thing in the Shach, Rav Shabtai Cohen, who is most well known for his commentaries on different parts of the Shulchan Aruch. The Halakha Shach wrote poetry, wrote slichos. He himself was a survivor of the Khmelnytsky massacres, and there's an introduction to his slichos that he wrote, that's called Megillat Eifa, in which he tells us at the end that one of the reasons why the 20th of Sivan was chosen, because that was the first, and one of the reasons why the 20th of Sivan was chosen is because it resonated with the earlier tragedy. This time, the 20th of Sivan fast day became etched in Jewish ritual practice. I Xerox at the bottom of page 3, twice from the Magen Avraham, once from the Taz. I spent time in the library. I found about 50 Slichos books that were published after 1650 that have a special ritual of Slichos to be recited on Chaf Sivan. Chaf Sivan was a staple. Fasting on Chaf Sivan was a staple of the ritual life of East European Jews until the Second World War. Why Chaf Sivan? I know why Chaf Sivan for Blois, that's when it happened. Why Chaf Sivan for Khmelnytsky if it lasted a year and a half? Because that's when it began. Which brings me now to the Shoah, page 4. Some of you may know that as we speak, there is a debate raging in the state of Israel as to whether or not the state of Israel should have a constitution or not. And even those who believe that the state of Israel should have a constitution, there's an even more intense debate raging as to what should be included, what should be the wording of that constitution. State of Israel has no constitution ad hayom hazeh. However, the state of Israel does have what we call a declaration of independence. In the United States, we have a declaration of independence, and we have a constitution. In Israel, there's a declaration of independence. It's called Megillat HaAtzma'ut. There is no constitution. Azirak's the beginning of Megillat Ha'atzma'ut of the State of Israel. That's the top of the last page. In 1945, there were many Jews who were survivors, who made their way, broken and destroyed, to the shores of Eretz Yisrael. By the time the State of Israel was founded in May of 1948, we don't know exactly, but somewhere around 25 to 30%, roughly, of the population in the State of Israel when it was founded were survivors. The State of Israel had a really hard time dealing with the Holocaust. On the one hand, the Holocaust represented precisely what the State of Israel wanted to fight against. Never again will Jews be victims. Never again will our fate be in somebody else's hands. The Holocaust for them was an embarrassment. The Holocaust for them represented a mindset of Jews that they were sworn to eradicate forever. And so they didn't want to deal with it. It was humiliating. It was embarrassing. It was the opposite of what they wanted to produce. On the other hand, there is an expression in English that's called, there's an elephant in the room. There was an elephant in the room of Israeli culture, and that was the Holocaust. 25-30% of a population. How can you not talk about it? How can you make believe it didn't happen? How could you just forget about it? How could you ignore it? The problem was compounded because many of those survivors who made their way to the State of Israel also didn't want to talk about it. We know survivors ad hayom hazeh who don't want to talk about it. It's just too horrific. And we need to understand that and be sensitive to that. They just wanted to get on with their lives. There was tremendous upset. They were overwhelmed. Why is it that I was spared and my entire family was not? The mama, the tata, the kinder, the brida, the shvesta. It's horrific. You can't talk about this. Certainly not right after it happened. And so in a sense, there was a kind of a conspiracy of silence in the State of Israel. Those who were living there through the war didn't want to talk about it. The big, starke, gesinnte Zionists. And the survivors didn't want to talk about it. But how could you not talk about it? And in fact, it figures prominently in the Megillat Ha'atzma'ut, in the founding, foundational document of the State of Israel. The Holocaust plays an absolutely central role. I'm not going to read the whole thing. You have it here at the top of page 4. Whole history of, of the background of Shivat Zion, the return to Zion. And they talk about 1897, the first Zionist Congress. And they talk about the Balfour Declaration in 1917. And then we come to HaShoah. Shenetcholola Imam Yisrael Bizman HaAcharon. The Holocaust that in our time destroyed millions of Jews in Europe again proved beyond doubt the compelling need to solve the problem of Jewish homelessness and dependence by the renewal of the Jewish state in the land of Israel, which would open wide the gates of the homeland to every Jew and endow the Jewish people with the status of a nation with equality of rights within the family of nations. Despite every hardship, hindrance, and peril, the remnant that survived the grim Nazi slaughter in Europe, together with Jews from other countries, pressed on with their exodus to the land of Israel. And continue to assert their life, their right to a life of dignity, freedom, and honest toil in the homeland of their people. And so something had to be done. Not only that everybody in their own winkel and in their own Landsmannschaft and in their own shtiebel and in the privacy of their own homes and in their own hearts remembered what happened, but it was deemed necessary that the State of Israel as a state should be able to establish some kind of a national commemoration. The first speaker of the Israeli Knesset was Yosef Shprintzak. Yosef Shprintzak appointed a wonderful Jew by the name of Mordechai Nurak, Rabbi Mordechai Nurak, to head a subcommittee of the Knesset to come up with a recommendation as to how the State of Israel should commemorate the Shoah. Rabbi Mordechai Nurak was in Latvia. He lost his wife and two children who were killed by the Nazis. He came a broken man to Eretz Yisrael. He was a political leader in Latvia. He became a member of the first Knesset under the banner of Mafdal, of Mizrahi, Miflaga Datit Leumit. He was a leader of the Mizrahi, the religious Zionist movement. And Shprintzak, who was a secular Jew, understood that if the state of Israel wants to do something meaningful, it has to be imbued with the sensitivities of our tradition. And so, who's more appropriate than a rabbi who's sensitive to the nuances, who'll be able to put together something that would not only be true to the tradition, but also speak to the sensitivities and sensibilities and feelings of those who were living in the emerging Jewish state. And so they had a series of meetings. A couple of years ago, I went to the Knesset in Yerushalayim, and I went into the archives, and I asked to see the minutes of Rabbi Nurak's subcommittee. They were very nice to me. They brought out the minutes of Rabbi Nurak's subcommittee. It's behind plastic casing because the papers, if you touch it, it's going to crumble. It's old yellow with the typewriter that's pushed through to the other side. And I was able to Xerox about 100 pages of all kinds of material that relates to the Holocaust in the early years of the State of Israel that has not been published. I Xerox one little piece to share with you tonight because this is, for me, crucial to understanding the significance of Kristallnacht in the world of Holocaust commemoration. There's something privileged about Kristallnacht, Dafka Kristallnacht, and that's why this synagogue and this community is to be so commended for drawing attention to this night. It's not Yom HaShoah only. It's not Asara B'Teves only. It's not Tisha B'Av only, Rabbi Schneidman taught us. But Kristallnacht needs to be on the map of Jewish memory. And I'm trying to make a case. So they had a whole debate in the subcommittee. They decided they're going to do a day. That's what Jews do. We do days. So what day is it going to be? So they had a whole fight. This is before the 27th of the month of Nisan was determined to be what we call Yom HaShoah V'Hagvura. This is the stuff that's going on behind the scenes in the subcommittee. And the committee meets on March 13th, 1951. And Rabbi Nurak reports, third line, Bevadat HaMishneh, Hishtatfu Achaverim, Tisling, Brenner, Aleph Raziel Naor, and himself. V'chulanu higiyanu b'deya, and we all agreed, sheyesh l'kayem yom achid k'yom hashoah v'hazikaron, v'chein b'yom meret hagita'ot. We have to understand that the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising was central in the calculus of Israeli historical memory at that moment, because for them to have done something only for the Holocaust would have been impossible. Because the Holocaust was so problematic, the only way they could wrap their minds around the Holocaust is if they would somehow link Yom Achid, link Holocaust commemoration with Yom Mered Agitaot. We fought back. We threw Molotov cocktails. We let those Nazis have it. We're tough. If you can access that, then we can have a conversation, Nebuch, about what happened during the Holocaust. How many people were involved in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising? How many people were involved those days in April of 1943? Maybe a couple of hundred. A couple of hundred? 6 million? But that's the only way they can get to the 6 million. And so Rabbi Nurak understood there's got to be a linkage. In fact, you'll notice what the day is called. It wasn't called yet. Yom HaShoah V'Hagvura. You see the number on the top with a little arrow? Yom Mered Hagita'ot. That was the name of the whole day of commemoration. We're going to call it Mered Hagita'ot Ghetto Revolt Day. And the Ghetto Revolt is, of course, the Warsaw Ghetto. Lo banu lidei heskeim, however, bidvar hata'arich. We decided we're going to have a day. The day has to be a day that relates both Shoah, the destruction, the tragedy, the suffering, together with ghetto uprising, but we couldn't figure out what day it should be. V'hutzu'u shalosh hatzaot. And we had three suggestions. Haver HaKnesset Sizling said, likvoa et hayom be'erev Pesach. Should be on Erev Pesach. What happened on Erev Pesach? The Warsaw Ghetto Uprising began on Erev Pesach. So we have to do it on Erev Pesach. And there's a whole conversation that goes on. Nurak says to him, Sizzling, are you crazy? Are you crazy? We're going to have a Yom HaShoah? We're going to have a Holocaust commemoration day on Erev Pesach? You know what that is? And Sizzling says, and I Xeroxed it for you at the bottom, three lines from the bottom of the page, he says, okay, Ein zeh chayav lihiyot dafka be'erev Pesach mamash, ze yachol lihiyot yom lifnei ze, o acharei ze. Okay, you don't want it on Erev Pesach? Fine. You could do it the day before Erev Pesach. You do it the day after Erev Pesach. The day after Erev Pesach is Pesach. Zero for Tzizling. Zero. Pesach? Fair. Europe. Galus. Old. Old world. It's a new country. We're creating our own myths. We're creating our own commemoration. Fair on Pesach. Pesach means nothing to me. And Nurak, I could see in the yellow pages falling apart. I could see his vein is bulging out of his forehead. He's turning red in the face. He says, can't be. Can't be. But Sizzling said, Erev Pesach. You want Warsaw Ghetto Uprising? I'm going to give you Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. That's one option. Chaver HaKnesset Aleph Raziel Naor said, Biyom Protz Milchemet HaOlam. We should do it. I don't know when to do it. So many years of tragedy. Nu Chmelnitsky, there was a year and a half. Now it's so many years. Which day? Which day? You know what? We'll do it on the day World War II started. The Hebrew equivalent of September 1st, 1939. Vani hitzati et Yom Asar B'Teves. And Nurak says, and I suggested that it should be Asar B'Teves. We have a tradition on Asar B'Teves. The chief rabbinate, as Rabbi Schneidman mentioned, established already in 1946 Asara B'Tevet as what they called Yom HaKadish HaKlali. If you don't know Nebuch, when your loved one was killed, you want to say Kaddish? When am I going to say Kaddish? The least I could do is to say Kaddish. When am I going to say Kaddish? You'll say Kaddish on Asara B'Tevet. Says Rabbi Nurak, we should do it on Asara B'Tevet. And there's all kinds of stuff. Not for now. It ended up on the 27th of Nisan. And I want to make the argument this evening that in this list, we should privilege Kristallnacht. That if, in fact, we have a tradition that I've tried to demonstrate to you, already in the 17th century, that we fasted for Chmelnitsky on Chav Sivan, not only because we remember the Chav Sivan from Blois, but because that's when it began. So if that's when it began, it began not on September 1st, 1939, but it began tonight on Kristallnacht on November 9th. And maybe that's why this shul and this community tenaciously holds on dafka to Kristallnacht commemoration, because it's so important. And it's so special. When I stand before you here, judges of Israel, to lead the prosecution of Adolf Eichmann, I am not standing alone. With me are 6 million accusers, but they cannot rise to their feet and point an accusing finger towards him who sits in the dock and cry, I accuse. for their ashes are piled up on the hills of Auschwitz and the fields of Treblinka and are strewn in the forests of Poland. Their graves are scattered throughout the length and breadth of Europe. Their blood cries out, but their voice is not heard. Therefore, I will be their spokesman, and in their name I will unfold this awesome indictment. So began the opening speech of the Honorable Gideon Hausner, the Attorney General of the State of Israel and the lead prosecutor in the case of Israel versus Adolf Eichmann. And so I end this evening at this Kristallnacht commemoration in this very special shul. We gather here tonight to speak for them, for those who cannot rise to their feet, for those whose voices cannot be heard, whose ashes are piled up on the hills of Auschwitz and the fields of Treblinka, whose ashes are strewn in the forests of Poland, and whose graves are scattered throughout the length and breadth of Europe. In their memory and in their name, we pronounce tonight the awesome obligation, Zachor, Gedenkt. Remember.
I don't think Yashikor has enough, Rabbi Schachter, for taking us through this very special experience, but Yashikoach. As I asked you earlier, just give us a few minutes to bring this evening to a proper and dignified conclusion. First, Yashikoach to those who helped arrange the program, to the sponsors of tonight's program, Mr. Harwit, Herbert Harwit and the Chevra Kadisha, Mr. Julian Hamburger, the Education Committee, the Spears, and the individuals who worked on it, Rivka Galanti and the Education Committee, and Naomi Monash, Gates Monash. We're going to conclude now with the Malay, which we mentioned earlier, and we will be led in that by Rabbi Cantor Leon Kahn, and following that we will sing the Ani Ma'amin. And at the conclusion of the program, there will be a minyan for Marav, for those who would like to daven with us. Cantor Khan.
Israel Yishmi Beruach Hayim Bidei Hatzarim Natsim Yimach Shema Mizichram Kidoshim Utiyarim Engyonim Tzadikim Yisharim Tnimim Vigahane Tien chosam Lachin Parachamim Yastirem Seisek nafal yalanim Vizra Yitzirah Chaim is Nishmasam Adonai Unachasam Liyanuchu Bishalam Amishkavam
to everyone for joining us for tonight. I want to recognize the presence of Rabbi Block of the Washington Heights Congregation, Maria Luna, venerable democratic leader from the neighborhood who never fails to join us for these events. Yeshkoach again to everybody, and a special Yeshkoach doubly to Rabbi Schachter. Special experience. Inside for those who wanted to have Marba Bakasha.